Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week, we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we'll meet Snow Hill painter Paul Volker. We'll learn how Caroline County got its name and about companion planting in our gardens. And naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about paddling on Nassawango Creek. Painter Paul Volker had an early interest in cartooning, which evolved into work as a painter with a sense of humor. He attended Ohio State University for 3 years before jumping into his career full-time.
I had become so busy at that time doing actual art jobs for people, I thought, well, this is why I'm in school, so I was spending so much time doing that, I really didn't have time to do more of the academic stuff. However, I continued to be involved at the university, and I used to sit in on classes and participate in my spare time, which the professors liked. Found myself doing graphics, primarily in cartooning, graphics, menu designs, and things like graphic arts, and a lot of cartooning and illustration work for people. And then I was working on a mural for somebody on the front of a building one time, and really started to become fond of paints at that time, especially house paint. And I had been using ordinary art supply paint, acrylics, but I had a lot of gallons of acrylic house paint left over. I started using those, and now that's my preferred medium. And a friend of mine who does paint restoration, she said, oh, 100 years from now, they're going to love you. They'll just be able to go down to a hardware store and, you know, match the color.
Paul has done thousands of paintings showing various animals doing very human things, like drinking espresso. When you look at them, you can't miss his sense of whimsy.
Animals are a very good way of conveying the human experience and in a humorous way. And humor is actually the focus of my work. And humor is a highly regarded means of expression in theater, in television, in literature. I mean, the longest running TV shows are the Simpsons, things that are funny. But in the art world, humor is relegated to a very low status. It's like gags, or it's a joke, and once you get it, the painting's done. But I think it's possible to work on that more, really explore humor as a valid theme in art.
Mark Twain once remarked that in terms of humor, the further the pendulum swings out over woe, the further it is bound to swing back over mirth. Paul's animal paintings give the viewer a good laugh while poking fun at what is sometimes the darker side of the human condition.
Animals are funny because there's a lot of cruelty in the animal world, in nature. You know, you watch the old nature programs of, you know, big fish eating little fish and tigers eating, or lions eating gazelles or whatever. And it's not really cruelty to animals, that's just survival, but in terms of humans, it's a good way to reflect on the way humans relate to each other. Some of my favorite animals to paint are crocodiles and bears. I sort of just make it up as I go along. I don't invest a whole lot of sentimentality to my work. And although I do want my work to bring a lot of joy to people when they see it, I'm not too attached to it. And part of the reason is because I find that actually for me to be very inhibiting to do that. That's one of the reasons I use house paint on plywood, is because expensive art materials are intimidating to me. And one of my rules is frequently to paint, after I've finished a painting, is to just paint over it, even if it's good, and do another one and just let it go. And that gives me a real sense of freedom that it doesn't matter now that much if I destroy a painting or not. And because of that, I find I'm actually able to really let go and break a lot more rules and be a lot more freer with myself.
Paul's work is evolving from flat images into three dimensions and even working parts. He's using recycled materials like wood and paper pulp mixed with caulk and industrial glue.
It's kind of like paper mache, only it's rock hard. And I like the three-dimensional quality. I like the idea that people could sort of touch it, and because you're not supposed to touch art. And most of my stuff breaks a lot of rules. I don't have frames. I don't use canvas. I don't use oil paints. And you can touch the work. The painting I'm working on right now, which is going to be a very large work, will have 12 interactive pieces that you can actually remove from the painting and play with. But it features 12 old-fashioned TV sets on a board that looks like a store window, like an old TV store.
Paul says that people now often treat artwork more like a souvenir of their experience. For example, they take selfies in galleries and museums rather than more directly enjoying the work they see. His goal is to invite the viewer to break through the barriers that technology has inadvertently placed between them and the artist's work.
The goal of technology these days, with iPhones and iPads and that sort of thing, is to make a 3D interactive experience. So what I'm trying to do is, using the most low-tech material possible, which is house paint on plywood, is to create a 3D interactive television experience. And so I decided to make a series of television sets with knobs on them and black and white images on them, so which the user can actually go and turn the knobs and change the picture on the artwork. So it is, in fact, 3D interactive television, which is the goal of modern technology. But I'm trying to do it in, like I said, a completely rough, even the wood is rough and uneven, and the paint is gloppy. There's nothing smooth about it. It's not like an iPhone, which is completely smooth. This is bumpy and coarse. In the world today, we're getting all of our information on these glass screens, and we're losing that kind of textural quality to our experience. And so I want to create artwork that has, that you can feel the texture with your eyes. You could feel some depth. It's not just something behind glass.
Paul is opening a new gallery called the Green Pearl. It is so named because it sits on the corner of Pearl and Green Streets in Snow Hill. The combination gallery and studio space will give art enthusiasts a window into the creative process. This should provide a unique and enjoyable experience. On Friday, June 3rd, see rocker Nick Haglick play live at the brand new Green Pearl. You can see a video of this interview on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts, to see Paul's work and get a link to his website. Art strolls are definitely a habit worth forming. Every month, enjoy a great night out while supporting local artists and businesses. Galleries and shops stay open late. Opening receptions feature special gallery exhibits. Often there is free entertainment. Many of Delmarva's communities now have monthly art strolls. Visit our website so you can get in the art stroll habit. DelmarvaAlmanac.com/artstrolls. So what's in a name? Most of the history books simply say that Caroline County was named in honor of the wife of the last colonial governor of Maryland. However, there is a much more complicated family drama behind the name, worthy of any soap opera. Our story begins with the last Lord Baltimore, Frederick Calvert, who died in 1771 in Naples, Italy, at the ripe old age of 40. He had a terrible reputation for being a womanizer and generally living a dissolute life that led to his early demise. He left the bulk of his estate, including the colony of Maryland, to his illegitimate son in Ireland, Henry Harford. Henry's little sister, Frances, and their aunts, Frederick's sisters, Louisa Browning and Caroline Eden, also all received an annual allowance and the right to inherit should Henry perish before them. Caroline's husband was Robert Eden, the governor of Maryland. His job was to represent Lord Frederick, who was not terribly engaged in the day-to-day running of his province. Caroline and Robert were relatively well-liked by the people in Maryland. He owned racehorses, and they had a fine plantation overlooking the Chesapeake Bay, where they liked to entertain. He had relaxed the laws about traveling theater troupes, which were considered bad influences. When Lord Frederick's will became known, Sister Louisa's husband fought the will in court, saying that his wife was the only legitimate heir in the line of succession, being the oldest sibling left. Robert Eden had been named one of the executors of Frederick's will, along with two other gentlemen, Peter Provost and Robert Morris. The Edens and the executors took the side of the illegitimate Irish nephew, who was still under the age of 10. In order to further solidify his wife's claim, Robert decided to create two new counties, one named Caroline for his wife, and the other named Harford for their nephew Henry. This all coincided conveniently with a petition from some inhabitants of Queen Anne's and Dorchester's County who wanted to erect a new county for their, quote, ease and convenience, unquote. So Caroline County was created by an act of the Maryland legislature in 1773. Its county seat was named Edentown for the governor. The accent of the people there eventually led to the name being shortened to Denton, which is what it is still called today. You're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and this is the tangled story of how Caroline County got its name. For all their legal maneuvering, the Edens did not hold on to the reins of power in Maryland for long. Though young Henry Harford was made Lord Proprietor of the colony in absentia, with Robert Eben remaining as governor, shortly thereafter, on July 2, 1773, the lower house of the legislature repealed several of his tax measures, calling them arbitrary, unconstitutional, and oppressive. The proverbial writing was on the wall. Caroline and Robert's children wisely returned to England before revolutionary hostilities broke out. 3 years later, in 1776, Robert Eden followed, escaping by catching a ride on the sailing vessel the HMS Bowie, which was waiting for him in the Chesapeake Bay. Meanwhile, Sister Louisa Browning and her husband continued to appeal their case in London. As luck would have it, by the time it came before the court, America had declared her independence. The judge said he could not rule on the case, since he would not be able to enforce the property rights of estates no longer under the control of the British Crown. Basically, he said that they would have to come back at the conclusion of the war, which they all did. King George III made Eden the first Baron of Maryland in October 1776. Presumably, this was an act of confidence in their ability to win back the wayward colonies. Eden and his wife were awarded a substantial settlement and a pension for his service as Maryland's governor. On a strange little side note, the other executors of Frederick, Lord Baltimore's estate, that's Peter Provost and Robert Morris, made sure that the rest of the money Lord Calvert left behind did not go to waste. They respectively married Lord Frederick's mistress, Henry's mother, and his little sister, Frederick's other illegitimate child, who was only 13 at the time. Henry and Robert returned to Maryland shortly after winning their case, but the new American government refused to honor their claims to the property they owned before the war. Apparently, the lands had been put up as collateral for state bonds. As late as 1899, Henry's descendants were still trying to lay claim to property along the Potomac River. Not all of the family descendants were infected with an unrelenting propensity for greed. Though named for his reprobate uncle, Frederick Eden, the son of Robert and Caroline Eden, was an acclaimed scholar who wrote groundbreaking progressive studies on the fair treatment of the poor. Here on Delmarva, all that remains of this soap opera is the name of Caroline County. And that is probably a good thing. Caroline County is a really beautiful place to live or visit, and it bears no scars from the tangled origins of its name. No wonder people simply like to say that it was named for the wife of the last colonial governor of Maryland. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On May 20, 1815, Commodore Stephen Decatur, a native of Berlin, Maryland, sailed with 10 ships to suppress pirates raiding U.S. cargo ships in the Mediterranean. And on May 23, 1774, in solidarity with the Boston Tea Party, a protest against British taxes, the citizens of Chestertown, Maryland, enacted a set of resolves forbidding all sale and use of tea in that town. Unlike their New England counterparts, who took their stand under cover of darkness dressed as Native Americans, the Chestertown demonstration was conducted in broad daylight and without disguise. Activists boarded the British brigantine, the Geddes, and dumped her cargo of tea in the Chester River Harbor. Chestertown celebrates this historic event with their annual Tea Party, a festival of reenactments, music, art, and fun educational activities for the whole family. Find links and details for this and other heritage events on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history. It's time for a break now. When we come back, we'll hear about companion planting in our gardens. And naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about paddling on Nassawango Creek.
Support for the Delmarva Almanac is provided in part by EatDrinkByArt.com. an online guide to 18 different Delmarva towns and arts districts, where you can purchase your very own masterpiece while enjoying a meal and a night out. For more information about each town and a regional arts calendar, visit eatdrinkbyart.com.
Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe. Companion planting is an ancient practice that is being rediscovered and studied. Native Americans planted three crops together: corns, beans, and squash. These were known as the Three Sisters. Each of these were planted in one mound, with beans being allowed to grow up the corn stalk and the squash acting as a protective ground cover and self-mulcher below. Carrie Murphy, Extension Educator in Horticulture with the Delaware University Cooperative Extension, is on the phone to tell us about companion planting in today's gardens.
There's a little bit of literature and a little bit of research that's been done to support the idea of companion planting. Many vegetable gardeners who have been vegetable gardening for a long time, they swear by it. It's the idea of planting two or more plants together that are companions to one another, so they like to grow together and, in fact, have been noted to enhance production. For example, a lot of people like to put basil with tomato, and some gardeners will tell you that that enhances the flavor of the tomatoes. Some gardeners will tell you that the plants that they use as companions to the vegetables will attract pollinators and beneficial insects that, again, will enhance the growth of that tomato. Commonly planted vegetables like carrots and cucumber, eggplant, they have suggested companion plants. And then on the flip side of that, there are some plants that have been noted to not grow well with those particular vegetables. I think ultimately what vegetable gardeners or food gardeners want to see is better production. And so I think that's always the goal, is how can you grow plants together so that you get a better tasting plant, a better healthier plant, a better producing plant. And, you know, the more tomatoes that you can harvest, the better tasting tomatoes that you can have, I think, is really what people are striving for. So something that we've done here at the Extension office, we've gone ahead and the Master Gardener volunteers have actually designed and installed a vegetable garden here at our office, which serves as a teaching garden. And together with our integrated pest management specialist, Dr. Brian Kunkel, we've designed the space so that we actually have a perimeter planting around the garden of a number of native plants that we know will bring in pollinators and beneficial insects that will then target some insect pests that show up in your garden. The common example is aphids on your plants, and lady beetles like to eat aphids. And so we've tried to identify some native plants that really attract a diversity of beneficial insects that will help us to target some of the insect pests that show up in our garden. Marigolds is a common example. More than anything, it has to do with the fragrance of the flowers and the leaves, which has been noted to repel certain insect pests and also small mammal pests. And so that's one that people like to plant in particular sort of around the edges of their garden, or if you're gardening in a raised bed on the corners. So a lot of people like to tuck herbs in. Flowers that you can eat are a lot of fun too. So not only are they sometimes attracting beneficial insects, but things like pansies and nasturtiums, thinking about how much you can get out of your garden and, you know, what you can harvest, everything from roots to stems to leaves to flowers.
Companion planting is not only a good gardening strategy. According to Carrie, it makes for a much more interesting landscape.
I really tuck my vegetables and fruit, amongst my ornamentals. So it's a real blended way of gardening, I like to think of it. So every open space that I have between my ornamental plantings, I tuck greens and cucumbers and herbs and whatever it is that I want to grow that particular season into existing plantings. And so you really can walk around my entire yard and find something to eat. That was one of my goals. And I just continue to have fun with that.
Visit delmarvaalmanac.com/gardening for links to area cooperative extension offices, a companion plant list, and a list of edible flowers. That's also where you can find links to local produce stands and CSAs. After all that gardening, next weekend you'll deserve a delicious break. On Saturday, May 28th, check out the Berry Delicious Strawberry Day at Furnacetown. This annual event features all things strawberry and a friendly competition between local dessert makers. That's also the day that starts off a Somerset County celebration of soft-shell crabs. Bicyclists can work up an appetite with a soft-shell sentry. Riders have the option of following a 62-mile route or a 23-mile route, both passing through some of Chris Field's most picturesque and historic areas. And the next day, Sunday, May 29th, it's the 24th annual Softshell Spring Fair at the Crisfield City Dock. They'll have arts and crafts, kids' activities, entertainment, and of course, softshell crab sandwiches. Find links and details for these and other home and garden events on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/events. You're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about paddling on Nassawango Creek.
One of the best early spring outdoor outings on Delmarva is paddling a kayak or canoe on Nassawango Creek near Snow Hill, Maryland. There's something very special about gliding along dark water under your own steam on a cool, crisp morning as the heat from the sun begins to warm you and every other living thing in the Bald Cypress Forest. A tributary of the magnificent Pocomoke River, the Nassawango is perfect for all ages and skill levels. The creek's gentle waters provide a natural path for paddlers who aren't skilled with a compass or GPS. Honestly, there's no way to get lost back here, but you'll feel as if you've trekked through a wilderness waterway after paddling just 2 hours on the Nassawango. You don't have to own a boat for this Delmarva experience. The Pocomoke River Canoe Company in Snow Hill has you covered. You can't miss it. The Barn Red Building is a Snow Hill icon and sits right on the bridge crossing the river along Route 12. Built around 1924 near the railroad that served the town during its former industrial era, the building once served as a warehouse for the Cordry Company. The shop will arrange everything you need for a safe trip. Most importantly, they'll deliver you to the launch site at Red House Road and pick you up when you're done. It will enrich your experience to know that you'll be paddling through what was once Maryland's largest Native American settlement in the late 1600s. The Canoe Company crew is very helpful, and they will provide a quick paddling lesson for those who need it. They will also help you slip your boat into the dark water from the launch installed by the Nature Conservancy. We are so fortunate to have this community conservation organization working on Delmarva. Some of our most pristine protected lands are managed by the Conservancy, including the 9,953 acres that make up the Nassawango Creek Preserve. The champions for the preserve were Ilya and Nassawango Joe Fair. In the 1980s, they prevented the damming of the Nassawango and convinced the Nature Conservancy to preserve the swamp and upland forest that drains into it. Whenever I paddle here, I think about Ilya and Nassawango Joe and what their work years ago provides for us today. Look down as your paddle gently carves the dark water. The Nassawango was the color of tea that has steeped a bit too long. The color is caused by the tannic acid that seeps into the water from the decaying leaves of cypress trees and other plants that line the bank. Some visitors think the creek is dirty due to the dark appearance, but the water quality here is actually quite good. One possible benefit of the tannin-rich water is that it is not favored by mosquitoes. You'll be pleasantly surprised by the lack of pesky bugs. The Nassawango is dominated by bald cypress. These majestic trees form the northernmost stand of these southern swamp ecosystems. While paddling the upper Nassawango near the launch site, look to the creek bank for the knobby knees of the bald cypress. The most likely purpose of these elfin structures is to support the tree in the saturated mud of the swamp.
Bald cypress also feature wide, buttressing trunks that make them look like trees from a tropical rainforest. Although grouped with evergreen cone-bearing trees, bald cypress trees are deciduous and shed their needle-like leaves in the fall. They get the name bald because of their appearance after they lose their leaves. The giant cypress seem to be the preferred host for resurrection fern, which looks like greenish-brown shag carpet growing on the tree's thick horizontal branches. This amazing fern can lose up to 97% of its water content during an extreme dry spell. During this time, it shrivels into a brown clump. When it rains again, the resurrection fern will come back to life and look green and healthy. The swamp provides perfect habitat for a wide variety of animals. During the early spring, before the trees have leafed out, you'll notice large piles of sticks near the water's edge. These carefully crafted structures are beaver lodges. If you paddle too close when there are young in the lodge, a protective parent will swim towards your boat and slap the water with a loud whack of its flat tail. This is a warning to move along. River otters also love the cypress swamp. Look for a fast-moving line of bubbles breaking the water's surface in front of your boat. If you're patient and quiet, you may be rewarded with a glimpse of a playful otter coming up for air. While not everyone will see a beaver or an otter, you will see and hear the birds. The Pocomoke-Nassawango region has been declared an important bird area by the Audubon Society of Maryland, D.C., for providing habitat critical to sustaining native bird populations. Of the 24 forest interior-dwelling birds known to nest on Delmarva, 21 breed regularly in the Pocomoke-Nassawango area. During a slow, meandering paddle in the spring, you are likely to be rewarded with multiple sightings of the magnificent Prothonotary warbler. The males are bright gold with greenish-gray wings and can be found singing loudly from cypress knees and low-lying branches along the Nassawango. Other birds you might encounter include wood ducks, blue-gray gnatcatchers, and pileated woodpeckers. Partially submerged logs along the route provide basking platforms for painted and red-bellied turtles and northern water snakes. Depending on your pace, and I recommend a slow, meandering drift so you don't miss out on the natural sights and sounds, you'll see the Nassawango Bridge after about 90 minutes of paddling. Ancient trees, dark water, singing warblers, and basking turtles. Although not a true wilderness adventure by definition, it sure feels as if you've traveled, on your own power, to a distant wild place and all just 10 minutes from historic Snow Hill. Until next time, I hope this story inspires you to explore Delmarva's many natural wonders.
Thanks, Jim. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, the Community Foundation of the Eastern Shore, and underwriters EatDrinkByArt.com for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.